Hey everyone, I'm taking the summer off of new podcast episodes. This summer I am teaching a research reading seminar class at George Mason. It's an online master's class for practicing health and physical educators as a part of our 100% online master's program. So this summer I'm going to launch episodes that I assign in that class. And as a part of the class, we definitely read a lot of research articles, but then I mix in some of the podcasts. So I let the experts talk about their research that have published in previous episodes. So these are all episodes that have launched previously. So maybe you've heard them before, but I know there's a lot of content and people miss podcasts all the time based on various reasons. And these are all really good podcasts. I hope you enjoy them. I will be back in mid-August with an awesome podcast about the state of physical education, teacher education in the U.S. with a recent paper that was published by Dr. Phil Ward. So these are going to be launching every few days for the next couple months. I hope you enjoy. Hey, Risto here at George Mason University. I'm here with Kyle Kuz and Matthew Hodler. From the University of Rhode Island to discuss their article, Saturdays Are for the Boys, Barstool Sports and the Cultural Politics of White Fratriarchy in Contemporary America. The article was recently published in the Sociology of Sport Journal. You can find the full citation of the articles in the show notes. And I first off, before I introduce you to articles, awesome. It was super well written. It was really interesting. And as I just said, I had to look up at least three or four new words. But it took me down a rabbit hole because I went down and started looking at the docuseries that you analyzed. But just a really fascinating article. So welcome, Matt, back. And Kyle, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us. Really appreciate being back.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Thanks for having us.
So first, I didn't think I knew Barstool Sports. And so when I read the article, I was like, oh, I've heard about it, but I don't know anything about it. And then as I read the article, then I started going down the YouTube rabbit hole and watching this, and I saw the flag in the background. And I was like, oh, I do know this company. And I do remember these controversies. And also some of them, like people that I know and like, students have these, like, you know, when Zoom happens, like you have Zoom classes during the pandemic, I see this flag and I'm like, oh, that's the flag. And then it just like unraveled a lot. But I know there are some listeners that don't know what Barstool is. So can you start off by giving like a little bit of a history or maybe just like an overview for like non-US based people who might be listening to this?
Yeah, I mean, it's, as we said in the article, it's a huge multi-platform media and sports gambling and lifestyle behemoth. So it's hard to describe really quickly, but essentially it is a, they call themselves a sports humor media company run by a guy named Dave Portnoy, or founded by a guy named Dave Portnoy in 2003. Or the common man, by the common man, was the original tagline that they still kind of use to kind of as their mission statements. And it started off as a free newspaper driven by ads that gave gambling advice and just sports commentary up in Boston, and was really Boston-centric for the first few years of its existence. And then sort of in 2008, 2009, is when it had been online for a little bit, and then it just kind of took off and became kind of like a northern cities, mostly Boston, New York, and Chicago, sort of sports news, blogs, humor, quote-unquote humor information, and they have, but they've grown into this huge podcast site. It's really big with colleges, I know, in the Midwest. And I have a colleague at Towson University I was just talking to the other day that sees Barstool stickers all over the place. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I really described what it is yet. As we say in the article, it's a fratriarchy. It sort of seems like a digital frat, quote-unquote frat house, where it's a bunch of guys just making content about sports and about humor and about their life. YouTube videos, podcasts, and blog posts that you can sort of kind of immerse yourself in that lifestyle 24/7, 365 days a year if you want to. It's kind of a fascinating thing. It's really popular with our students up here, or at least it was when I first got here. I know that it's pretty popular everywhere else. Did I miss anything?
That's fair. I mean, the only other thing I would add is just it also kind of expanded by using, you know, not unsurprisingly, for a space that's, you know, geared towards young men and their tastes and things like that, but it really used local images of Boston kind of women, scantily clad, to like really expand its like footprint, both like locally and then digitally.
Yeah, you're talking about having to look up words. Like, I had to look up the word smoke show when I first started looking at Barstool, because they really relied on local smoke shows where they would like take pictures of off the internet of women, local women, and put them on there as a way to drive traffic in their early years, like that kind of thing.
And sometimes without really their consent, right? Like they was just like scraping a picture off the internet and putting it on and bringing people to the website.
Yeah, and it really drove traffic that way. And they often did it with celebrities without their consent, and also without paying the paparazzi who took the pictures, or the media who took the pictures as well. And that was like an early driver of their
And I mean, I looked up some of the numbers you talked about in the paper. Like, they have 62 different podcasts that, you know, are getting listened to by like 7 million people, you know? So it's just like a massive, you think about the ad revenue that you can pull in on that alone, like, and the market. Like, obviously these are maybe like smaller, like the Baltimore like podcast or the Cleveland podcast, but that's like, that's a media empire, you know, in a way.
Yeah, I mean, the previous, or at least one of the previous iterations of Barstool, as it expanded outside of Boston, was to really try to like create other local centric, kind of like a Philly Barstool, a New York Barstool, a Chicago Barstool. And like, they tried to tap into some like local professional athletes who had big followings. Almost always they were like white male athletes. They would hire local people to get into the vernacular of the city. So they really saw themselves as like kind of the heartbeat, drumbeat of like local sport news. And they always had, I mean, part of what they did, they had this unique voice of like how young people were talking about sports, especially those like that slice of like young folk who were, you know, un-PC and kind of unapologetically so, and things like that. Like, that was my first, like, the first time I kind of was introduced to Barstool is by a student who was in my gender issues of sport and physical activity class. And I think in like week three, he like said to me, he just rose his hand. He's a kid from like Boston area, and he's just like, when are we gonna stop talking about all this feminist shit? And I was like, what? Like, did you not read the gender issues part? Like, you know, in the title. But he, you know, another like comment he made was he talked about, this is the pussification of America. And I was like, this kid doesn't really have like this understanding of American culture to come up with that phrase on his own. And I was like, where did you hear that? And he said, oh, you don't know about Barstool Sports? And that was like the first time I had heard of it. It was probably around this time of 2008, 2009. And so that, I mean, and I didn't really kind of go back to it, you know, actually till Matt came and we started to talk about what might we work on together. Right. But it does have a huge presence here in New England and Northeast in particular. And that's the only thing I would add to it. But...
The way that I kind of came to it too was thinking about this, something that you were talking about before we started recording, like seeing the camera or seeing the flags at like fraternity houses when I was walking to campus of a university I used to work at, or seeing the stickers on the computers of students when they come in, and, you know, like, or I'd ask my students, what's your sport media? Just kind of as a really quick way to get things started at the beginning of the semester. Like, what do you listen to? Where are you at? And invariably, they would mention a podcast, a Barstool podcast I'd never heard of. Or they would always mention Pardon My Take and Barstool Vant. I think Pardon My Take is actually not invented. It's Barstool Vant Talk. Oh, man. This is embarrassing.
Different shows, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm forgetting the name of them, so you can edit that out if I look like an idiot. But they would always mention these like really popular ones, and like I had not listened. That's not part of my. It just missed me. But it was. I feel like I'm losing the strain here. But it was really popular when we got up here in Kansas. And I had a colleague up here who is a Mexican American scholar, and he was telling, or they were telling me that when they saw the Barstool sticker on a student's computer, to them it was very similar to like sort of a closing off of a conversation.
Yeah.
It was almost like a stop sign. We can't talk about these things.
Interesting.
Which really helped me kind of like, we actually need to engage with this rather than sort of navigate around it, because that was one of the ways I used to deal with it. Was I just dismissed it. Which is not really the way that you should be handling these sorts of things.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because it's kind of pushed into a space through podcasts, what AM radio talk show was. It is still. Like when I was commuting at Cal State Fullerton, you know, when I was coaching, like I listened to Jay Moore Sports because I was on AM radio and that was during my time. And like I listened to that, and I don't listen to sports talk radio anymore, but that was a day-to-day occurrence. And I can understand, because then you start listening to how they say things, you understand the vernacular, you understand the inside jokes, and then I could call my buddy and like I'd say, hey, did you listen to Jay Moore today? And you know, I was very disappointed that he got canceled. Like when he got dropped, I was like, oh, what am I gonna do now? And then I discovered podcasts and I've kind of never looked back. But I think the way that you have kind of analyzed Barstool Sports is similar to like Joe Rogan followers. You know, like they are a group that really looks up to this one single person, but that's one single person. Joe Rogan hasn't like expanded to multiple podcasts that, you know, so. But anyway, we can go on for this, but let's get into the paper a little. I want to hear what the term in your title, you talk about white fratriarchy. Can you explain that so we can kind of start from that and then move forward?
So, yeah, one of our colleagues, Holly Thorpe, used this term that hadn't been used, I think, for about a decade. There was another sports sociologist, John Loy, and Doug Booth, I think, before that, or around the same time, used this term fratriarchy. So fratriarchy is a form of male rule that's different than patriarchy. So patriarchy is a form of male rule that's generally organized around the idea that there's a father that is in control and, you know, that kind of rules over the rest of the group. But fratriarchy is a form of male power that's really predicated on the idea that, like, male power can operate through brotherhoods. And the other thing about fratriarchies often don't involve and include all men, but they include a select group of men. Usually they're younger men, according to this guy, Remy, who coined the term. And they're usually men who want to create a social space where their values, their norms, and really kind of the general kind of ethos of the space is that they want to be able to do whatever they want without any constraint, without any penalty, without anyone, and in particular, without women telling them what to do. So when we, you know, when Holly Thorpe used this term in some research she did about snowboarders and the cultures that they create, especially because they were very male-centric and they might include some women, but the women had to follow the norms that the boys set and things like that. And that was the only way they would be included. So we thought this was a great like concept to use to make sense of Barstool. We kind of added the racial dimension to it because Remy and others didn't really talk too much about how fratriarchies operate racially. But one of the things we wanted to point out in this research about Barstool was just we were trying to kind of decode the ways in which race shaped the space without saying anything.
I mean, that's exactly it. For me, like when Kyle found this term patriarchy, it kind of felt like a continuation and a more nuanced perspective and a updated version of like kind of what Mike Messner had talked about early 1980s and 1990s about sports being a site of male domination, male-centric space, like sites. And like students can easily, and I can easily like point, well, no, women are playing sports now. Women are on TV now. And this was a way of seeing how this operates in a current space. And that idea sort of kind of runs through. And like the racial component, like we looked at a documentary series and there are less than two handfuls, definitely over like 7.5, 8 hours of video of a person of color getting to say something to the camera, right?
Right.
In this retrospective history of this entire thing. And then as Kyle pointed out earlier, they have a habit and a practice of getting white stars or white local stars like Gronkowski, Brady, Jay Cutler. Who's that quarterback for the Jaguars before Blake Bortles? Or was it Blake Bortles?
Bortles.
Like as these guys who were like, kind of like the either explicitly like being on stage with the guys in Barstool or being a part of their skits or promoting them by wearing their hats or whatever. And like this kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier. Like they added authenticity and like that idea of this is how guys really talk. And they really kind of brought that in. And it's overwhelmingly repeatedly white folks and white men who are doing this. And it's sort of, that's one of the ways that we wanted to think through how gender and race kind of co-articulated with each other in this space.
But you talk about in the paper that Barstool also started including women. What was going on at that time and how was that kind of like seen as a strategic move to get ahead of any criticism?
Yeah.
With the blackout tours and stuff like that.
Yeah. Like, then. Yeah. So like in, I guess it was about a decade ago now, they had these things called the Barstool Blackout Tours. And that, and interestingly, I just realized, and I don't know if we put this together. We did not put it in the paper because it wasn't necessary, but they were going to reinstitute these blackout tours right before COVID happened. And the blackout tours were these parties, and we kind of talked about them in the paper, where they would travel around and they started off as these kind of do-it-yourself events in colleges, and they called them quote-unquote blackout tours because they would just have black lights. Mm. And obviously there's a double meaning to this, at least one double meaning about getting drunk, blackout drunk. And then they turned into these wild events, and they very much, I think you're old enough, I don't know if you saw them, but like the Girls Gone Wild videos, yeah. Commercials, you remember those commercials in late night when you're watching ESPN? And this like kind of voyeuristic camera coming in and like lingering on women making out and then asking you to buy these DVDs. These blackout tours kind of had this approach, and there was obviously all sorts of drinking involved in these ones, underage drinking, towns were organizing against them. But there was a feminist group that was pretty successful in Portnoy in the documentary series. Talks about how successful this group is out of Boston University, right? He's at Boston University in Northeastern, called KO Barstool. And they were explicitly feminist, and they were talking about this was unsafe environment, and really pointing out to some of the history of sexism of the company, and Dave Portnoy in particular, his rape jokes, his misogynistic comments and writing, their justification of women, and sort of like this was like a coalescence. All of the feminist kind of critiques of Barstool kind of coalesced in this space, and then they were trying to sell their company, and they hired a CEO a few years after that, and brought her on as sort of like this way to deflect these comments that were being sexist. Because how can a company be sexist if your CEO is a woman? right? It's kind of like the basic way they used it.
And then her Twitter handle is token underscore CEO, right? Which is kind of like a tongue-in-cheek kind of joke back, and also, you know, so.
Well, her and another woman personality for Barstool had a short run podcast called Complicit also.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely interesting. There's a lot of layers to this. You know, in the paper, you also talked about politics and how Barstool has shaped the discourse based on like politics also, and how Donald Trump sat down during his 2020 campaign to interview with Barstool because basically they saw the data that, you know, that is Barstool is a really good place for capturing the attention of young males, that 18 to 34 age group that is really highly coveted by marketing. And then they started seeing that these, you know, males that were watching Barstool Sports are very conservative. And so can you talk about how politics is kind of interwoven into the whole Barstool Sports empire?
Sure. So the part of like what we wanted to point out was the way in which Barstool was always trying to be anti-political correctness. And their shtick early on was really kind of gender-based, where they wanted to create a space where men could feel like they could be men again, right? And I use that rhetoric even, I mean, it's kind of, the, you know, it's make America great again, right? It's a similar logic idea of the Trump campaign as well. And part of what we argue in the piece is that, you know, some people, as they, you know, as academics have tried to theorize the rise of the far right with the Trump presidency, you know, they talk about Trump as a starting point for these ideas. Part of what we argue is that if you actually look at the history of Barstool, Barstool kind of predates a lot of the rhetoric and ways of acting as a white male. And I'm sure we'll get into this in a second, being a big man sovereign, where, you know, you're just going to do what you want, act king-like, you're going to be fully free, and in particular, fully free of kind of progressive norms and values, right, especially as white men, that Barstool was doing all that in their space before Trump came along. But the other half, I think what we try to do with, like, Barstool is say that, you know, in the moment when they do the Barstool documentary series, it's a moment when far-right ideas that used to be, you know, extremist and not get a lot of play in the mainstream are now being brought in through the Trump presidency, in part through online spaces, you know, that are becoming super popular through Gamergate, you know, men's rights kind of movements and things like that. So this idea that kind of men are in crisis, which is a perpetual kind of idea that actually keeps patriarchy kind of being reproduced over time. But like that, because of like the amplification of those ideas online, that sense that, like, you know, there's this end of men going on, particularly end of white men, is an idea that becomes really popular. Barstool taps into that. And what we wanted to point out was the way in which Barstool also seemed to be trafficking in ideas about race that were very similar, very homologous to a lot of the white nationalist ideas that were popping up at this time and becoming more popular. And in particular, you know, the ideas like people on the far right, white nationalists were, you know, saying they want to, you know, have America become a white ethno state again, right? And kind of have all, you know, not allow immigrants of color in. And, you know, Trump had some of those comments about shithole countries and even saying they should, you know, we should have more Scandinavian immigration. So we were trying to point out the ways in which Barstool was producing images of America, images of Boston that were really white-centric in ways that didn't match up with the demographics of the city, even. And just, you know, I think one of the main points we're trying to make in our argument is some people would say these ideas only exist in the fringes, in the far right. And we're trying to say, if you look closely at Barstool and you know, the content of these far right ideologies, these ideas have been in the space of Barstool for at least, you know, half a decade, if not a decade.
Yeah.
And we think as sports scholars, you know, that's something we should be pointing out, especially in this time when culture is so central to the ways in which politics works.
And they claim that they are apolitical, right? Like, that's what they talk about. But as we're talking about the Barstool documentary series, the opening introduction for Dave Portnoy is by Tucker Carlson, which is a political figure, you know, like, he's not in politics, but he guides a lot of political thinking in the U.S. for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, this is where, like, we had a lot of really interesting, productive conversations about, like, how much overlap is there in terms of the far right ideology in Barstool? How much is it explicit? How much is it implicit? Part of the challenge is that there's, like we pointed out, there's so many different media outlets. I mean, I had a lot of students that just said they only listened to one podcast from Barstool and they hated Dave Portnoy. And so we had to like think through, how do these ideas permeate throughout? What kinds of claims can we make about these comments? I think part of the reason why we need to analyze the politics of Barstool, I mean, one, as you pointed out, and as Kyle was saying, there's this rise of the Barstool conservative kind of argument, especially immediately after the election loss of Trump, and this idea that this is the future of the Republican Party. But a lot of my students just face value when Dave Portnoy said, we're not political, we're not a political company, they just believed it. And they ignored the fact that they used to sell Make America Great hats again at their shop. They ignored the fact or didn't know that Dave Portnoy wrote a pro-Trump op-ed and basically endorsement for his first election and then went to the White House in 2020. Like that sort of like idea that we're going to say we're apolitical and then that means we're apolitical is a really potent study. And as multiple cultural stars before us, including Kyle's work earlier, that where somebody says they're apolitical, often they're being political, yeah. Obviously.
And I think it's, you know, you talk about this in the paper that it would be impossible to analyze the entire Barstool sports industry in a single article. But you selected the Barstool documentary series, and I'm wondering if you can explain what that is, so people can understand, like, what was the lens or what was the piece of Barstool sports that you actually analyzed for this paper?
The Barstool documentary series is, I think it's got 15 different individual videos or kind of stories that together, the way Barstool presents it, this is meant to be their collective story of the history of the company. You know, we figured once we were talking about the idea of doing this research, we're like, look, we might get a lot of pushback for this, you know, from all sorts of different places, whether it's local or whether it's even national, for these right-wing groups. So we were trying to figure out what's the way in which we can do a responsible critique of Barstool that would be difficult for them to dismiss. So we thought the Barstool documentary series would be a perfect text to focus on because it's the story they wanted to tell about themselves. Mm-hmm. It's not our cherry picking from all this different media. Like if we've been talking about how much media they produce nowadays, you know, they could easily say, well, you're cherry picking from this podcast and that podcast to paint us in a negative light. So we thought we would just try to use what's the story they want to tell about themselves and show that even that story is one that doesn't hold up if their claim is that they're apolitical and they're just trying to tell some jokes.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that kind of came out still out of this idea of, we saw a lot of like solid, well-meaning like journalism and journalism criticism and like just saying Barstool's a racist company, right? Barstool's a sexist company, but we never saw anybody explain how necessarily. And so that notion about needing to explain how and also wanting to make sure that we made a good faith critique took them for the story they wanted to tell about themselves is kind of how we chose that. It also fortuitously came out in March of 2020.
Yeah.
When everything else was shutting down. Yeah. I mean, we started our conversations about Barstool basically meeting for coffee during the pandemic outside in spaces that were safe at that early era and where we could actually just keep thinking and talking about stuff as a way to for me at least, it was a really helpful way to reconnect during those really kind of uncomfortable and unsafe and kind of unsure early days of the pandemic. And I just caught myself. I remember we were talking about it and I started watching that documentary and it seemed ideal for what we were trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was interesting because I was reading your paper and then it got to the part about saying, like, if you look inside the quotes, you can copy and paste this into YouTube and it'll take you to that specific video. And I was like, all right, let me watch one to see what it's like. And I just like, your paper's over here. And then I just like sat there for 16 minutes and watched the first episode. And then wow. I went back to the paper and then I was like, wait, I thought that video in a weird way was like a critique of themselves because all of the stuff that the first episode talks about, like all of the blackout tours, all of the stuff that they like, all the jokes and all this stuff that's like, I don't know, it's pretty off color in certain, you know, to put it lightly. And then I was reading the paper and I was like, oh, wow, like this is what they say they are. And this is what they're really proud of. Like this is their documentary series and they published it. And, you know, if you go in there cold without the understanding of being built up as a sports fan and you just dropped in and you watched that first episode, you know, it's surprising that a major multi-million dollar company is advertising itself as what all the stuff that they're doing. So you had four different categories, and I'm wondering if you can kind of briefly just explain, like, for example, one of them was Barstool's big man sovereign team. What does that mean?
So big man sovereignty is a term we take from the late like cultural critic Lauren Berlant. And she did this short piece where she was trying to make sense of Trump's appeal prior to his victory in 2016. And, you know, she focused on the rallies that like got so much attention, if you remember at that time. And she thought like what his followers were really kind of connecting with was this sovereign way that he was behaving as a white person. And that he could just say whatever he wanted to say, and he wasn't bound by the norms and constraints of, you know, political correctness, or he didn't feel shame or guilt for just defying kind of progressive ideas about the world. And so she said, you know, he was kind of displaying and performing this big man sovereign, big man style sovereignty is what she called it. We tried to make it a little shorter. But I mean, it's a perfect way of explaining how Dave Portnoy acts as well. Like his whole shtick is just a similar thing where it's, you know, he's not going to follow any of these PC norms either.
Right.
And it's a very kind of masculine way, you know, defiant, kind of useful, rebellious way of like acting as well. And I think, you know, the argument we want to make is that coupled with fratriarchy, this way of being, a kind of defiant, masculine, kind of white person who just won't be bound by other people's kind of norms or constraints, coupled with the formation of these like white brotherhoods that will include some women so long as they know their place and they conform to the norms and values of fratriarchy, mm-hmm. that this is kind of the formula, the model for kind of a white backlash in this moment. And you can see it, you know, I mean, it, in the conclusion, we try to hint at this where we say, you know, you can see the Trump presidency is organized kind of in this sort of way. If you remember the news conference Trump had where he had all of his cabinet members around the table and they essentially did a loyalty oath.
Yeah.
and there are a few women there, but it's this very kind of, you know, fraternal order way of behaving. But you know, it's the way in which the Proud Boys work.
Yeah.
It, you know, we say it's kind of the ways in which the Federalist Society seems to work. You know, it's the way the Supreme Court is working now. It's, you know, Kavanaugh and Tony Barrett on it, and
Gorsuch, yeah.
Yeah, and Gorsuch, or me, freaking Alito, really. Yeah. Alito is kind of the band leader there, it seems like. But in really kind of striking down Roe versus Wade. So, you know, I mean, that's the bigger claim we're making. I mean.
Yeah, well, and one of the things that helped me kind of think through this when we were talking about it was one of the ways that I had been reading a lot of white masculinity work, especially trying to analyze the culture in the late 2000s, early 2010s, was this idea of victimhood. And you don't see victimhood as the primary narrative coming out of Dave Portnoy and these Barstool folks. It is a certain kind of performance of big manness. And it isn't that they don't claim victimhood eventually or they don't talk about being attacked, but it's always from a posture of this sort of unapologeticness. Mm-hmm. And so you had written this thing earlier a few years ago about unapologetic whiteness, or is that the right word that you used? I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But like this big man sovereignty kind of helped tie all these together. And then we were seeing it everywhere. I mean, Andrew Tate, or the guy is a perfect example of what's going on right now. Joe Rogan, like I was going to mention that earlier. We did a conference in Las Vegas, and there's some scholars at San Jose State that are doing really interesting stuff on the Joe Rogan podcast and sort of its connections to MMA. I mean, Dana White would be another big man sovereign that I would argue maybe is a part of the sport in a sense, where they kind of reject that narrative of victimhood and they go on the offensive.
Yeah.
That sort of would be kind of how I would see it operationalized in that sense.
Yeah, you brought the second analysis, you brought in humor, and you titled it Restoring White Male Prerogative Through Fratriarchal Humor. Can you explain how humor has kind of come out in this docuseries?
They use humor as a way to say that they're just joking, right?
Right.
And I've been reading a little bit more about this. I'm going to go get this book really quick. I just got this book and I'm going to start reading. Your listeners can't see this, but it's called The Souls of White Jokes by Raul Perez, How Racist Humor Fuels White Supremacy. And I think some of the ways that like humor works in Barstool that we saw and that I'm continuing to see on other sites is that humor can be used to kind of obviously dismiss honest critiques of folks. Like, I'm just joking. I didn't mean it. Now you're the problem with this, right? So one of the examples that we talked about that we talked about in the reading, but also I talked about in class was the Housergate series, where years ago, was it 2009? Around the same time. Dave Portnoy posted a picture of naked Tom Brady's 2-year-old son and talked about how big his penis was and called it a howitzer. And that is a blatant sexualization of a child, right? That is a textbook example of child pornography. And he talked about how, of course I said it. I say this joke to my friends. And so it's this building of fratriarchy, and it's also used as a rationale for its own sake. Like, it's like, I would say this joke to my friends, so I'd be being dishonest to not say this to more people. And so it kind of builds that that sort of fratriarchy through this kind of shared experience. It rejects non-hegemonic groups and organizations, their critiques, because we're just kidding, we're not really being serious. It reproduces those dominant meanings and dominant understandings of the world. It kind of does that sort of hierarchical sort of putting it, but this idea of recognizing that everyone can be a target, because here we are making fun of Tom Brady.
Yeah.
it also is a great way for fans of folks to kind of sort of say, deflect criticism of that person. Well, he was just kidding. You understand his humor. Once you get into it, it's sort of like similar to the argument of it's out of context. And it is used, I mean, Jon Stewart did the same thing, right? Like, it's used as a way to sort of deflect that criticism of, like, I'm not a politician or I'm not a political person. I'm just making jokes. I'm not a sexist person. I'm not a racist person. I'm just making jokes. Right. We're not just a sports company. We're also just a humor company. It would be sort of the way that it operationalizes in there. I don't know if did I miss any of the kind of stuff that we talked about?
One thing we haven't talked about too much, but it took us a while to write this because even as we watched the Barstool documentary series, like it took us 3 or 4 times to watch some of these videos and figure out why does Barstool, like especially with Howitzergate, why is this like story and this incident important to their identity as a company and their ethos?
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's them making fun of this like 2-year-old. But
Tracy Miss is bragging about being child pornographers.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
But then we started to like try to, you know, figure out like what's really the dynamics that are at work here sociologically. And where the like white male prerogative comes in is, you know, the story becomes meaningful in that it's Portnoy in a standoff with, you know, the district attorney of Massachusetts or whatever the, you know, whatever her official title is. And it becomes this like power struggle between here's the boys just trying to have a joke and they should be able to say and do whatever they want. And here's this feminist killjoy woman who is intruding upon their like territory and trying to tell them what they can and can't say.
Right. Yeah.
And once it kind of gets framed in those terms, I mean, it sounds very much like, you know, a lot of the far right politicians who are using, right, kind of First Amendment free speech arguments to, like, you know, bring back white supremacy, would say, or white men's kind of power in society. So, yeah. And the prerogative is really a term I found from a historian, Stephen Kantrovitz, who studied Reconstruction. And I found it interesting that he wasn't using the term white male privilege, but he was using prerogative. I had to look up, you know, what's the difference between prerogative and privilege? Mm-hmm. But really, prerogative is the idea that, like, white men get to choose how the world exists and operates. And so, you know, we think that kind of idea, that idea is key to the dynamic of, like, Barstool, and it helps to make... It helps, I think, to make that story of Howitzergate meaningful and important to understanding how it works politically for Barstool.
Yeah, that's a good.
So,
yeah, because that makes me think right now about like when, like, you know, like the anti-LGBTQ right now. There's a lot of talk about groomers, and when you get to decide it's a joke, and when you get to decide it's pornography, right? When you get to decide it's about community building, when you get to decide it's about grooming, right? And that white male prerogative about choosing how to frame humor plays an important role in that. And we saw that, like you were saying, in the Barstool docuseries.
So you also talked about this idea of reviving Dixie through the allure of big white men and white patriarchy. And you talked about one of the episodes or one of the series that they talked about was like this Dixie storming tour that they went all to these college campuses, well, football college campuses, and had all these parties. Can you talk about how that kind of those align?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like, to be honest, like, this was something that Kyle kind of helped me kind of see a little bit more nuanced and in depth, because I spent a lot of time in the South growing up, and so, like, I didn't necessarily see kind of how it was operating. Like I in the same way that I think Kyle did, the guy that hosted out, Caleb Presley, was definitely the kind of personality that I could have seen myself when I was in college being the one that I watched, right? Like he's the kind of performance he did, the deadpan humor, He was one of the only people that I actually thought was, like, you talked about humor earlier. I don't really think Barstool was that funny in many ways. And he was one of the ones that I kind of could see how he was humorous and why people liked him as the personality. That's not to say that I didn't see it, like, critique it, but, like, Kyle kind of helped kind of push through and look at the context of this Dixie Tours in 2014, 2015 is when, and Caleb Presley used to be the UNC quarterback, UNC football quarterback. And he became like the fun officer for the football team or morale officer.
Yeah, director of morale or something like that. Yeah.
Director of morale. And then basically the way that we kind of, or Kyle kind of positioned it is like, he kind of joined in Barstool because he was becoming pretty popular. And one thing that Portnoy's good at is finding talent that can kind of reproduce what they're doing. The analysis about the Dixie Tour.
I think the Dixie Tour, in part, Barstool is trying to find a way to expand itself into the South. So it decided to use, you know, the story is Portnoy was watching a UNC game on ESPN. He saw this story about Presley. I imagine like he saw him as competition. So he just, you know, said, hey, why don't we give you a job? But then he gave them a budget, him and two other guys, to go down and just like do this barnstorming tour with a big, you know, a bus and emblazoned on the side, it was Dixie Tour with like, you know, the Confederate flag. So at a time when, you know, Bree Newsom is doing her protest where she climbs the flagpole in South Carolina to protest their continued use of, you know, Confederate flag. This is the Obama era as well. So there's all this kind of, you know, birtherism and anti-Obama, you know, kind of rhetoric and ideas, especially in the South. You know, it's a time when Barstool decides to make itself, you know, a little closer to this history. So it's one of the ways in which, you know, as it tells a story that it's apolitical. I mean, you can't be apolitical in the Obama era and, like, you know, position yourself more closely with the Confederacy. Yeah. I mean, those two ideas just don't, you know, cohere.
Yeah.
So, you know, but we found it interesting, the footage that they did show. You know, it kind of was trying to celebrate, you know, college football, you know, tailgating cultures that they went to and things like that. But one of the things we found really interesting was the way in which they did make a stop at a historically black college, North Carolina A&T. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, there was no party footage at all. So there's this, you know, part of like doing close critical readings of media like this is not only to look at what's there, but also to like think about what's not being shown or what is in the frame and what's not in the frame. So we found it really interesting that they decided to show as part of this Dixie Tour footage that they made a stop at an HBCU, but there was no party footage. And, you know, how do we make sense of that? And I remember I showed, as we were like finishing up this research, I started to show a couple of these Barstool documentary series episodes to students. And, you know, one class just said, like, well, you can't call, like, Barstool racist if they went to the HBCU.
Yeah.
Like, and that actually, it was the students, like, talking us through that, where it was like, oh, this is how the logic works. This is how they would get around this sort of critique of them being racist. They're trying to be inclusive so the argument would go, right? But just black people don't want to go.
Right.
And that's often from, you know, a white point of view that doesn't contemplate what it would mean to be like a few people of color in a, you know, predominantly white space that's not just a kind of neutral white space that's maybe like, you know, ruled and organized by, you know, university officials, but it's ruled by young white men who their express purpose there is to party and do whatever the heck they want.
Yeah.
Well, you know, especially in the South, that's the recipe for especially black people not necessarily feeling too comfortable.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but all the, you know, to think about that for especially white students who, you know, here in New England, they have to know a lot more history than most of them know to make those sorts of connections. So,
and I think Matt, you said something about like as you as in as a college student, you would have liked one of these specific characters or one of these hosts. Like I analyzed this too and thought, because before I went to New York and took classes on, you know, critical theory and took classes on, you know, social justice and all this stuff, like I was a college wrestler, and like that is a, especially earlier on, very homophobic, very like very specific people wrestle. And I wrestled, and it's just like there's, you know, the locker room talk and stuff like that you don't talk about, like that stuff happens, right? And I could totally see myself uncritically being a fan of Barstool Sports as a college student and a recent grad. And, you know, like, and it's because I would have gotten to it through friends who watched it, who shared it with me, who talked about it. That was the thing that we would talk about. Or, you know, I'd, you know, zone in for fantasy football picks and stay for the other commentary. And so, like, I can see how this is so interesting to students. And it's also our job as people who are educators in sports and physical activity and, you know, for me, like physical education, to critically analyze this. And like, this is why I think your paper is so great, because it, you know, it's a sports thing. So let's not talk about the politics or the education piece of it. But if the sports people, if the physical activity people are not looking critically at this, then it doesn't get, you know, named, it doesn't get explained, it doesn't get critiqued, because it's kind of like in this buffer zone of like you said, like people just say, oh, it's racist. Well, show me why. Like,
Yeah. I mean, I'm a little bit younger than Kyle. But I'm working on a project on this right now about the early history of Barstool. And I know that we've been talking about this, like, it came out the same time as like Tucker Max. Maxim was really popular. FHM, like this kind of popular, as we talk about in the paper, this popular misogyny, this sort of yin to the yang, or yin, whatever, backlash, or like what north to the south of popular feminism that was going on in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I definitely kind of like, I had to reconcile a lot of this while we're watching is like, I would like you said, I would have liked parts of this. I would like to have thought that like, I wouldn't have liked a lot of it, just even taking out the fact that I still wasn't always clued into racism and sexism in the way that I try to be and am now. Just like, I wouldn't have liked some of it because it just wasn't very good. I wasn't a part of the online scene. I mean, I came to the internet later than a lot of other folks just because of my own sort of stubbornness. but like I, like you're saying, like I kind of wanted to lean into the fact that I would have liked this as a way to help me critique it. Like you were saying, like we have to, as critical scholars, but also as educators, we have to kind of grapple with this stuff. And I think that made me a better co-author, a better critic. It's helped me with students, like talking to students about this, like because I kind of get why they're initially drawn in to that sense. Like you were saying, like locker room talk is a complicated idea that we need to unpack. And it is a practice. It is a thing that happens that helps reproduce a lot of these ideas that we were talking through. It's funny, my girlfriend is from New Boston. She's a little bit younger than me. But she talked about how when she was on the dating scene, how Barstool was all over the place.
Yeah.
And like meet the guys that she met when she was, I don't really want to paint her in this. The guys that she met were very much into Barstool, and like the guys she went to college with, the guys she went to high school with, because she's from that area. And like, it was one of those things where didn't necessarily kind of like we're talking about, you understood why it was popular, but you also sort of were like thinking about it critically in that way and trying to, but you didn't always have the tools to make sense of it.
And that I think is key, is like, you don't have the tools to make sense of it. Right. So like, it's just, like we could say it's just media, right? It's the same way that other media empires just get you to believe what they say. Is because it's a podcast. It's recommended. I get hooked. I don't have anything else better to do, or just it just comes on, or whatever it is. It's the next thing that the algorithm suggests to me. I dive in, and a lot of it is like it's something that you do by yourself. Like when you listen to a podcast or you listen to audio, like you don't do it loud when everybody else is listening. Like you have your headphones on, or you listen to it in your car alone, and that's like something that you think about by yourself, and it's in a way it's passive, right? The social media obviously you can control, but like in a way, like a podcast is passive. You just listen to it, and if you don't critique it or other people don't talk about it, sooner or later, like you're a Jay Moore sports fan for 3 years, and you know, like you don't critique it because there's no reason to. You just take it as truth, you know. And I had that kind of reckoning with Joe Rogan. Like I listened to Joe Rogan all the time when I was commuting from LA to Fullerton. Like I probably consumed 9 hours of Joe Rogan on my commutes, like every week, and doing like I listened to him all the time.
Like one show?
Hmm?
It's like one episode?
Yeah. No, but I liked it. And then I started, like, I heard something that I was very familiar with, and the person totally said something wrong. And I'm like, that is incorrect. That is not true. And you're talking about this person that I know that is not, that's not where they live, what they do. And I started becoming, like, really, like, critical. Like, wait, everything he said I've taken as truth over the years. And I didn't think about that. And then I started thinking about like, oh, I don't know if I like listening to this person anymore, because I think I've been like brainwashed by this person, because I never talked about anybody else, or like I've never talked about the podcast with anybody else really. And then I just like, it just fell off a cliff, and I haven't listened to him in like years. And my friends are like, hey, have you like heard this last Joe Rogan episode? I was like, no, like I'm not going to dive in again.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, I was just going to say, early on, we had a conversation about, you know, we were both, you know, college athletes as well. And it's like, yeah, I'm sure if, like, this was, like, the popular media when we were in college, like, we'd be sucked into this, too. And we were trying to figure out, you know, how much we'd be sucked in and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But I think we always did try to, you know, approach this critique in a way where we don't, you know, like, kind of like two things. We don't want to say, you know, the guys, like, we don't want to say the guys who are, like, or the people who are, like, consuming this are dupes,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. And we also don't want to say that everyone who listens to Barstool is somehow being radicalized.
Right.
Right? I think those are too simplistic. So, you know, especially, and I also want to say, our analysis in some ways is kind of dated, because we're doing this critique of like a Barstool that really doesn't exist anymore.
Yes.
This new Barstool with all the podcasts is a different iteration of Barstool. So we were doing this kind of critique of Barstool when it
had this
main kind of thing it was doing that was more singular than this proliferation of media that it is now. So, I mean, I'm always trying to be careful now with students when I talk about Barstool, that it's like, I recognize Barstool's a lot of different things because it has so many different podcasts.
Right.
But here's some things you should think about, you know, as you're listening to it, and it's shaping how you see the world. I mean, you know, obviously the classes we teach, we're trying to give the students critical tools so they can, you know, create a little crack. So they'll have that moment you had where it's like, wait a second, that doesn't make sense with like these other things I know in the world. But, you know, I imagine for a male athlete whose team is surrounded by like Barstool, who can, as you say, consume these like podcasts on his own time to whatever degree he wants to. That creates a pretty sizable, you know, wave of culture.
Mm-hmm.
That's washing upon your shore daily, telling you this is how the world works. And that's the thing that we're interested in trying to expose. You know, and not to say that, like I said, not to say that it radicalizes and that's the end point. Because I think in a way, like all, if we're thinking about it politically, all Barstool has to do to win this struggle is convince enough young white men to say, you know what, fuck diversity. They don't have to be like Proud Boys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They just have to be like, you know what, I'm no longer interested in, when I hear CRT, I'm done. When I hear feminism, I'm done.
Yeah.
And it, you know, that's the moment, that's the political moment for me.
And that's a license that they get from listening to that big white man sovereign, like that idea of this is how I can be. I can just shut it off because it's difficult to like dig deep into how I feel and how my parents brought me up and who my friends are and what they think. And it's easier to just say, no, I'm not into that PC stuff. And I teach a sociocultural class, sociocultural issues in physical education class. We talk about it in general in sports and society. And, you know, I have people from all across the spectrum of political beliefs in that class, being in Northern Virginia, which is a lot more of like more liberal leaning kind of people who listen to the content, dig into the content and agree with, you know, the way that a lot of scholars write, right? But then I do always have one or two or three students in there that they just like, they have a wall. And I know that I will most likely in 15 weeks of class not get through that wall, but I can like show that crack. I can just show like just a little bit for them to maybe think about it in 5 years. Because if you would have told me at 21, when I was in college as an undergrad, some of the stuff, like, you know, I dropped out of philosophy class because I didn't have to have it to graduate. And the first class was, you know, like write a paper about what is a pencil. And I was like, get out of here. I'm out of here. Like this class is dumb. Like, and now like, I like reading like philosophy books. Like when I was in college, I read philosophy things and I took a philosophy of education class. It was one of my favorite classes ever. And it was because I just wasn't ready. Not that the professor in college was dumb. Like, he was great. We were supposed to read all the books that he said, there's only journaling in the class and you have to read these 7 books. There's no exams. And I was like, great. And then he started talking. I'm like, I'm out of here. And, you know, like, I don't know. I think that there's definitely 100% people in my classes that think the same of me. And they're like, what is this guy talking about? Like, why do I have to read about feminism? Or like, why do I have to understand what this argument about critical race theory is? Because I've already made up my mind and it's hard to break through.
Yeah. Or they'll say, well, it's about sports, so this stuff doesn't matter. Yeah. I get a lot of students from like, I had a mentor that used that phrase, like kind of what you were talking about, the crack thing, but she would say, we're planting seeds, and hopefully in 10 or 15 years, they'll grow into trees or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a very nice feeling when you said you get like the students that are just like staring back at you like, I don't care about this. You're not going to make me care about this, and I'm not going to do anything about it. I'll just show up, and I'll get my grade, and I'll leave.
Write papers that appease you, right? They understand the system. Like, if I tell them to write a critical paper about this or this, like, they're smart. They're intelligent college students, and they can get an A in my class and fake it, honestly. Like, I know that some of them do, because then the conversations I have afterwards, I'm like, well, why did you write this paper? I'm like, oh, well, I thought that's what you wanted me to write. I'm like, ah, like, missed opportunity, you know? Like,
yeah, definitely. Yeah, they do know how to tick the boxes.
Yeah. So is there anything that we've left off, or like a takeaway message? I mean, I've had a very enjoyable time chatting with you, but I'm wondering, like, is there like anything that we missed or anything that you want to leave off with as we kind of close out the podcast?
I've enjoyed my time too. I don't I don't know. Like,
I think this is a good spot to leave it.
Yeah.
I mean, I really appreciated being on here and being able to talk about it again.
Yeah, seriously, it's a good conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
And so I'll link to the paper in the show notes, and just want to thank you both for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.